Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in the studio today is Ms. Mamoloko Kubai, Member of Parliament and Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services. In Parliament, she has served on the Portfolio Committee of Basic Education, Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and prior to this, she was the ANC Proportional Representative from 2006 to 2009 in the City of Johannesburg Municipality, and also the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Transport in the same period. She has also served in the ANC Youth League as a Provincial Executive Council Member in the Gauteng Province, and on the academic side, she holds a BA degree from Vista University and a Project Management Diploma through Damnin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I'm really excited to be here and to talk about the journey that I've taken to be where I am, but as well, quite an interesting topic around women empowerment and women leadership. Thank you for the invite.
It's an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to engaging with you further in our conversation today. Now, starting off, can you tell us a little bit about the committee that you're heading, what your tasks are, what you aim to achieve?
My committee currently is, I'm chairing the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, which is an oversight committee to look at what happens in the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services that the minister is Minister Cwele. Under that portfolio, we've got the department, we've got entities such as South African Post Office, we've got Universal USASA, in short, that is known, Centec, we've got BBI Broadband Infraco, we've got .zna, domain name, that is responsible for your .org, .za names, we've got INESI, which is responsible for e-skilling. So those are the entities that fall within this portfolio that we look after.
It's quite a broad remit.
It is definitely quite a broad and quite fascinating environment, I must say. So being here, it's one of the most challenging environment, but very fascinating. I've learned a lot since being here. So we literally, and as a portfolio, we focused more around using telecommunications as a tool to empower especially rural women and children. Because if you are to understand the impact of lack of communication infrastructure, if a mother sitting with a child in a rural community does not have an access to be able to make a call when there's an emergency, that is a human rights issue for that woman. So that has been my priority. My work has been focused, even when we do oversight, we've literally focused on the rural areas because, I mean, for us, those who grew up in the urban areas, currently today we have LTE access, which is like your internet access, 3G, most of them, high-speed connectivity, whereas in rural areas, they don't even have access to 2G, which is just an enabler to just make a call. So you get to other areas, there is no cell phone coverage. I've been to those areas since I've been a chairperson of the committee, and you get embarrassed to say 21 years down the line on democracy, you still have these challenges.
And from an urban perspective, we almost take it for granted.
Definitely. That's what I'm saying. If you are sitting and all you need is like you check in the speed, it's not even around the issue of access. For those guys there in the rural areas, it's literally the inability. And my view on this issue is to say we are perpetuating, when the situation is like this, you are currently perpetuating the inequalities. Because if you are to take a rural child, let's say a girl child, from a rural area who has never been able to have access to internet, this child passes matric, comes to the urban area, has to compete with a child that has gone, let's say they go to vets, they get into the same class with a child that has been in St. Hest High, who has been able to use computer, to have access to internet, can Google things, can do projects. This child must first learn from a rural area, what is Google, what is a computer, how do I search. Now, if you look at that, there's a gap, and that's why sometimes you've got to understand why some of them battle when they get to universities. and why you'd end up with high drop rates, mm-hmm. dropout rates. So those are some of the challenges. And for me, it has been about pushing the sector, pushing the department to say we need to make sure that at least all communities have access to communication infrastructure.
And in that respect, there's accessibility is one point of view, so having the infrastructure there, having the access. But another perspective is ensuring that individuals are equipped and skilled to be able to understand how to utilize that technology so that they can derive the full benefits from it. And not long ago, we had the Minister of Department of Communications, as well as Deputy Minister of Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services on the show. And they've said that from an ICT point of view, there have been significant endeavors of adopting gender and ICT strategy to guide the implementation of gender empowerment programs. Can you tell us a little bit more in terms of how you're seeing ways in which we're encouraging women to pursue opportunities in the information communication telecoms sector?
I think there are a lot of opportunities for women in the sector. There are few women, actually, that you'd find very active in the sector. Recently, I know there's been a platform which has been created for women in ICT. It's in its infancy stage. They just started this year, and we're looking forward to seeing them growing in the sector. But I think for a more sustainable approach would be to go and find young girls in high school, encourage them to do maths and science, encourage them to take ICT as a career, do most of the things. I mean, you find less people around spectrum engineering. And if we are to tell the truth, I mean, most of the things that I know today, I did not know about them when I was in university. I was a maths and science student. I was a top student in my school. But I never knew about these opportunities, though I decided to go and do something else. But the truth is, maybe I could have gone into this field if I knew these major opportunities. I dreamt of becoming a doctor, and I left that dream at some point. But I was a maths and science student. And if at the time when I did my matric, this information was not available. So more and more even today, we need to push for young girls to know about these opportunities. Mm. Because you need to start even telling them that, you know, for signals, you need engineers in this area. Not only engineers, because majority of people know electrical engineering, metallurgical, mechanical. Those are the basic ones. But they need to be exposed to more and more of this careers that exist within this field, and which I feel that we have not even started to really tip, at least if we can get even to a certain extent 5%, because I don't think we are even at 5% of these young girls or young boys and girls, especially from disadvantaged areas, to go into universities in this field.
You're absolutely right. And on two issues there, one in terms of creating greater awareness of what those opportunities are. But the other point that you're raising is that half of these opportunities didn't exist when you and I were at school and going through. Within this particular sector, it is evolving continuously, and there's new opportunities that are coming about. And I think that almost highlights the fact about continuous learning and being open and receptive to these new elements that come through.
I think definitely that's one that's very critical. We've got to remain open-minded about what is there, but more importantly, just create a platform for these young people to come through to the system.
We spoke a little bit earlier about the rollout of broadband into rural communities, looking at it as an enabling factor. How do you see that access coming about? How do you see us getting there faster?
Look, currently it's really moving very slower than we expected. I mean, we would have liked to see at this point the 8 districts that have been identified having been rolled out already, because these are rural communities, rural districts that needed to connect in terms of ICT broadband. Because if we are to look at broadband, I always say ICT becomes the backbone of growing the economy. for a person to come and invest will look at your communication infrastructure because they want to be able to communicate to the world. They will look at the quality of your internet access. Are they able to connect into the internet? If you are to grow local economic development, if you are to have local economic development in these rural areas where you start addressing the issue of influx into urban areas, you need to address this issue. Now, you can look at it in broad ways. You can look at it from education, e-learning. If the kids in school, at high school, all of them are able to have access to internet, gadgets that they can Google, they can do all these things, they're able to do on their own independently, do research on the internet because it's an enabler. You go to health as well. If you have this, then, for example, if somebody, Minister Motsoaledi, talks about, when he speaks about e-health, he talks about the ability for ICT to enable, for example, if you have a TB patient, you can send an SMS from the hospital to say, reminder, this is your time to take tablets. You need to come and collect your tablets. There's a program that they have in Department of Health, which is called, I think it's Mumps something. They send an SMS to for prenatal clinic classes for mothers. So you come in, if your date is due, they send an SMS. The system allows them, they capture all the details of the mothers. They send an SMS to say, you need to come for checkup, you need to do this, you need to do this, remember to eat healthy. So it's a program that they started when they realized that we were not making progress on maternal mortality rate. And that has worked very well. So it's one example. So if we are able to fast track the rollout of broadband, this is what it means of the South African system. I don't have to be running around as a citizen trying to find information. Government should be able to, within a click of a button, somebody anywhere can have access of who I am. Unlike now, I go to this department, I register all my details. I move from this department, I go to the other one, I still do the same. Whereas government system should be synchronized. Government system should be talking to each other. But the current method, because the reason why we have this is because we've not been able to have a full rollout of broadband across the country. So it should be that if I move to Eastern Cape, I don't have to be carrying my files of the doctor, of this and everything else because I'm moving there. But if everything is electronic, it makes life easy.
Today we're talking to Ms. Mamoloko Kubai,
Member of Parliament and Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services.
Hi, I'm Zonke Dikana, a South African Afro-soul musician, songwriter and producer. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band, also available on DSTV channel 902. Today we're talking to Ms. Mamoloko Kubai,
Member of Parliament and Chairperson of the Portfolio
Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. In our previous insert, Ms. Kubai was speaking about the rollout of broadband from a nationwide perspective in South Africa, particularly in terms of its enabling capacity for not only for our rural environment to service the needs and services required by women in those communities, but also looking at it as an integral asset and ICT across all aspects of life, whether it is from the e-learning point of view, whether it is from e-health or down to our management within the criminal systems. Ms. Kubai, this program is all about gender equality, which is increasingly a global focus, and as such, building female leadership capacity is important for the future of women in Africa and across the world. How do you see female leadership, whether it's in the parliamentary space, schools, business sector, or any other environment for that matter?
I see women leadership quite playing a very, very critical role. I mean, you take from the time of Mama Sophie Du Brain, the leading of the March of 1956, to currently, you see women not allowing themselves to be pushed in the corner, allowing to say, our voice is going to be heard. It's being a woman in a political space. I've worked in the private sector, I've worked in the public sector, and now a public rep. It's never easy. And I can say if as a woman, I would love to see a woman who can say, look, I walked into an environment and things were just smooth. Most of us as women, we walk into an environment, you have to do the double that a man does. If they do 50%, you do 100%, because most of the time you've got to prove yourself that you're worthy of being there. And it shouldn't be, literally. But unfortunately, because of where we come from, our past has literally, and how we've been socialized. I mean, you go back to our houses, when mothers, who specifically are female, would even say to a boy child, there are very few families where you find a mother will treat a boy child and a girl child equally.
Right, that socialization happens at the onset of childhood development, because those are the structures that are guiding our youngsters as they're forming their opinions, what their identity is, what the gender roles are. And if it doesn't happen at that young age, then you risk going off into different tangents.
No, I mean, that's what I'm saying. It starts there. Most families don't realize it. They're perpetuating patriarchy by saying to a boy child, you can go, the girl child remain, it's late, you are not supposed to be out, girls can't be out at late. Even the same thing, you buy a doll for a girl, you buy a car for a boy. I mean, those things, can we change them? It's another debate, but those are some of the things that perpetuate the separation, perpetuate the inequalities. We as children, or the children as they are growing up, they'll never see themselves as equals, because there is that difference in treatment. The girl will go and wash the dishes, the boy will go and do the garden.
Does the fact of being a woman make gender equality, do you think, closer to your heart and make you more determined to create a real difference?
I think it does, because you experience it from the, you know, firsthand. It does. I grew up, I'm one of those, I grew up in an environment where I was not, I wanted to define myself outside what was. One of the girls who grew up without wearing a dress, refused to wear a dress. Today I love wearing a dress. But at that time, because I was forced to wear a dress, that I rebelled against the dress. I would want to go to school with a trouser. And at school they'll say, but why are you wearing a trouser? And people thought I was a tomboy, but I was not. I was just a girl. And I just didn't see why I should be defined within these parameters that I didn't see myself within. I didn't do sewing. I can't sew even today at school. I refused to do it. I did gardening because I love gardening. I love flowers. I love planting, cut my grass and all those things. I grew up like that. I didn't play with dolls. I refused to play with dolls. In university, I would wear all-star a jean, a belt, a t-shirt, and a cap most of the time. And to the point that one time when I started working, I was at the airport and I met one of my university lecturers, and we're like, wow, is that you in heels and a skirt? And then like, this is me. But so you find yourself as a woman leader as well, pushing, and you become sensitive to those things. You pick them up quickly. If you find a girl child as if they are being oppressed, you are able to see that quickly, more than a male colleague. I'm not so sure why, but perhaps maybe because of our environment, how we grew, you knew the difficulties. I always have time to sit around the table with young girls, share experiences, and tell them who I am, how I grew up, and what made me push to be where I am, because I think it has never been easy.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you faced and experienced in your career?
Look, at times people would not expect you to do it, to make it. People would expect less from you, from a political environment. I mean, we grew up in an environment where women are reduced. I always fight with young women to say, don't reduce yourself to being a person who just raises a hand and say, I'm seconded. You know, you must be able to have a political view. You must be able to read. You must be able to engage, because most of the time, male colleagues in a political environment, they'll sit and start a discussion. They don't expect you as a woman to start engaging. They expect you to sit there and be a doll and look at them and just nod your head. When you start raising arguments and you find those eyes, oh, who is this? I've had those instances. I've had where I go to a platform, I start speaking, and people say, oh, you are one of the different women. I said, what do you mean? Why are you saying I'm one different woman? I'm a woman. Why are you, you know? Because the environment of politics, most of the time, it's such that it gets rough And if you're not strong, others retreat. Even strong women, even not really strong, brilliant people with quite brilliant ideas tend to be reserved because the environment it's not really quite inducive for you to speak. At times, I remember when I was in university, I was the branch chairperson of SASCO. I was a female in a executive of males, and I've had to go back and ask them, why did you make me the chairperson? And they told me, you were very problematic in our meetings. You always disrupted our meetings, so we had to make sure that we stop you from disrupting. But the challenge I faced at that time was that we had a place called Tridlala. It's like, we call it Tridlala. It's a township lingo in Soweto, but it's like the third house. So there was a third house which provided alcohol closer to the university at Vista, Soweto campus at the back. Now, most of my male colleagues would go there, sit, have alcohol or sit, but in that process have political discussions. Now, you come, you are chairing a meeting, they have a view, they've concluded their agenda, they have their perspective. You're trying to push through the idea and you realize, but what is happening? Everybody agrees here. I'm the only one. Until I took a decision, I'm going to join them at that platform. If that's where the decisions are taken, I'm going to be there to take that decision. If I need to stop it, I'm going to be there to stop it for a decision not to happen. And those are the things that you learn to survive, unfortunately, as a woman leader. So I started at that early age to understand, okay, I have to understand the space. I have to understand that there's no one who's going to bring it on the silver platter for me. I've got to make it work.
But also the point that you're raising is in terms of how business in general, whether it is in the political space or whether it is in the private sector, is conducted. It's not necessarily in the confines of the structured environment that it's supposed to be done, that it does happen in informal settings where you have those conversations and engagements. And if you're not having access to them, then it excludes you. And from your point of view, it was getting down and joining those discussions so that you had a space to express yourself and manage the situation.
I definitely agree. Today they happen still in the bus. They happen in the golf field.
Yes.
If you can't play golf, they're going to take a decision, come back, the deal is done.
And in many ways, there is often an exclusionary factor for women because those are social scenarios and traditionally she has to look after the family, look after the kids. So often she excuses herself from those occasions and events to spend time with family. Mm-hmm. But yet from a boy's point of view, and I use boys in inverted commas or men's clubs, they have that freedom to go and participate in those environments.
Yes.
The next question I want to ask you, given your experiences, particularly your direct experiences, are what areas do you think we need to build on the most to benefit women in the future? And do you think that 50-50 representation is possible and can be achieved?
It is possible. It can be achieved as a start. It can be something that we sit on for the future. It's something that assists us to equal the playing field. But going forward, if I always argue, if we can have 80% of quality women, that's correct. I also say to those women, don't think because you are here because of 50-50, you must fold your arms and not do anything. Because what you are doing is that you are doing disservice to those who are coming after you. Because somebody is going to sit and say, but this 50-50 does not work because of you. Now, we equally have a responsibility that when the space is opened, we need to make sure that we utilize it effectively as women, but we utilize that space to bring more women in.
It's opening that pipeline.
Yes.
And access. Today, you are an MP and you're heading up the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, and you deal with issues which are fundamentally going to change the lives of almost every, I say almost, in fact, every South African citizen for the better for the years to come. And as such, in effect, you've become a role model, providing evidence to many women and girls in the country that with hard work and personal sacrifice, everything can be achieved. Can you share with us some of the responsibilities that come with being a Member of Parliament and having a demanding career?
Yeah, it's quite not easy. I always say I'm a modern-day migrant worker. You are Monday evening, you fly to Cape Town to be in your committee because Tuesday is a committee meeting. You start very early in the morning, you finish very late in the evening. That happens throughout the week. Friday evening, you fly back to Johannesburg. you must try and catch up with some family issues, but as well do constituency work, do political work. It's a very, very challenging. I mean, part of the sacrifice I had to do, unfortunately, was to take my son and put him into boarding school, meaning that I was an absent parent for some time. Because most of the time he's at boarding school with teachers there looking after him. I'd go pick him up when it's either optional weekend out or compulsory weekend out and spend some time with him. By that time, most of the people will tell you, I've dragged him along with me to my meetings, because there are times where it's just not feasible. So if it's a meeting on Saturday, I pick him up, we get into the car, we go to the meeting. He gets angry at times. At times he'll be excited about it. But that has been the journey. And it helped for him to understand what I do.
But it also gives him a very unique exposure of the world to a new world view.
It does. It helped him. I think he's quite very independent in thinking.
And politically aware now, I'm sure.
He's quite aware. He's very conscious. But yeah, it sort of make him understand that mommy is just not vanishing to be somewhere. It's that. But having been, because it was not easy. I had my son when I was a teenager. So he's just completed, he was in matric this year. But the issue is, throughout that, it's the sacrifice that I said to myself, I'm not going to leave myself to live in poverty. I grew up with a single parent who was working as a domestic worker. Now, part of seeing my mother battle with us as five kids at home, it was not easy. I'm the third born, I'm a middle child. So, very independent. I've taught myself, and I told myself, I'm going to break the barriers. I'm just going to go and out there and do it for myself. I've never had the opportunity to have anyone do anything for me. I had to push doors. I had to knock at doors. I had to kick at doors for things to happen. I started working at an NGO, as a field worker at ICDA. It's Interfaith Community Development Workers. That's my, I think that gave me a really formidable ground in terms of working environment. I knew we got there, it was more internship, there was nothing much. 2000, I had to survive with it, but run around communities, get women, assist them with their grant, because part of the project we're doing would get women who are on grants, who are getting grants, to let them...
Government grants.
To let them start a project. Say, out of your 100 rand that you get from government, take 10 rand we set aside, you're going to start a development project. That's what we were doing at ICD. So we started, others would sell coal because we look at the environment where they were staying. What is would make sense? Okay, coal, we start with one bag, selling it with containers. Then eventually you get two bags, you get three bags, and it starts as an economic development. That's what we were doing in communities when I started. It really opened my eyes, because at times as a young person you thought, look, it's only us. I mean, when my stepfather, because I was raised by my stepfather, died, we had to move. My mother lost everything, and we moved to live in an informal settlement. It was difficult for us to adjust. My mother lost her job. She got sick, and things were rough. I went to university with no backing from home. Thanks for government. I got the NSFAS. Currently, it's called NSFAS. At that time, we were calling it TEFSA. That's what gave me opportunity to go and learn. I became a student leader. I survived through my student allowance as a leader of the SRC. That's what made me get my grant. I told everybody, I said, I'm here for 3 years because I can't afford another year. I have to do my junior degree, finish, and go and start looking for something. I was fortunate to get an ICDA. Many young people conclude their university degrees, junior degrees, and they sit at home. I was fortunate, but I was pushing doors. I never sat back. We were two. One friend of mine who was coming from University of Venda, from the rural areas as well, would knock the two of us, would walk from one office to the other in Bromfontein, dropping off our CVs. That's what we used to do. I started working at Edgar's just to get money to get into a taxi and submit CVs, make copies of CVs. That's the journey that I took. It was not easy, but you had to kick doors. That's when immediately I finished that. I went and did my project management diploma. I enrolled financing myself at Damelin, so that I realized I need to do something. Immediately I concluded, I started submitting my CVs with agencies. I got to go and head a project in I was a project coordinator at Nedbank at CLB. Started working there. It was not easy. Walked into an office one day, found a meeting room full of white males with their shorts, khakis. And they looked at me, they started talking in Afrikaans. Heaven knows, I can't speak Afrikaans, I can't hear Afrikaans. Sitting there, I looked at them, I kept quiet. I was supposed to participate in this meeting. People are talking in the language I don't understand. Then eventually I said to the project manager, look, the project sponsor at that time, look, I don't speak Afrikaans. I don't hear Afrikaans. If I knew your business language would be Afrikaans, I wouldn't be here. That was me.
And so everybody's eyes
went. I said, because they wanted my contribution. So they were talking and then they wanted my contribution and I asked, guys, I thought you were just chatting. And everybody, they went red to their faces. And I said, no, but I don't hear, I don't speak Afrikaans. I grew up in Soweto. I was born after 1976. So Afrikaans was banned in my township. You would not speak, you would not hear Afrikaans. It's the same thing in politics as well. You get environment where people want to make you feel that, no, you are not in exile. I was not in exile because I was not born. It's not my doing. I say, judge me by my contribution based on my age. That's my view. 1980, I was almost around 4 years or 3 years around there. Now, if you expect me to say I have struggle credentials, I don't. And I'm not apologetic about it. Don't make me feel as if there's something wrong with me.
But the reality is, you are the next generation. You're not part of the older generation that went through with the struggle to get us to where we are today. But it's an integral part of where we're moving forwards and succession planning. And you fundamentally have demonstrated what hard work has done, how you've acquired your achievements, and also with integrity of confronting issues where needed. Now, Ms. Kabai, as someone who has not only been an advocate and a supporter of education, but has sat on an education committee in Parliament, you know that education is a vital tool to empower individuals and societies. In your opinion, do you think that we as society are doing enough to ensure that knowledge is preached in every forum possible, and information in particular is passed from mother to daughter, especially in underprivileged communities?
I think we need to break the education from formal and informal. From the formal based, I think we've done quite enough in terms of accessibility. Today, every child can decide to go to school. I mean, we've got free education in terms of your junior level, where when a child in primary, we've got no fee schools. Children receive school uniform, books, nutrition in schools. That as a form of ensuring that we've got kids that are kept in school and not taken out of school. Having studied in Vista, we used to even make an argument at the time when we called him Papa Action, Minister of Education, why do I forget his name? You see, this thing of calling people with nicknames, you forget that. I'll remember the name now. But when he did the mergers of universities, part of our submission as SASCO at that time, we're saying you are matching apples and bananas. If you take us from University of Vista University and you match us with RAU, Rand Afrikaans Universiteit, or VETS, our needs, our challenges are different. I remember at that time we were doing for access, financial exclusion, to say don't put percentage in terms of our accessibility to university and all that. And University of VETS students at that time were doing for extra parking. And we made an example to say, look,
it's a totally different agenda.
It's a total different environment. We don't even have cars to even think about parking. So we are battling just to have, I remember at that time, we're fighting for registration fees not to go up from 800 to 1.5. It was huge for us.
Well, it's nearly double.
I didn't know where I would find it. I saw myself as a student leader at that time that if this is not resolved, I'm in the streets. My future is doomed. So that's what you need to understand when you deal with education, especially at higher education level. But we also have to urge our young people to say, when you have this go and study, because some of them, they go there, they fail. Because you've got to prioritize education for yourself. The thing what we need to get out of here, young people, is this thing of entitlement. We need to let them understand that when an opportunity is before you, utilize it. No one owes you anything. No one owes you nothing. You've got to make it yourself. If an opportunity is in front of you, grab it with both hands and utilize it effectively.
Ms. Kubai, we are unfortunately running out of time today. Can you please, in closing our discussion, share a few words of inspiration that you would like to pass on to women in Africa that are listening to the show?
What I want to say is that there are many opportunities for us as women. We must go out and get them. There's one comrade Puli, at that time when I started being very active, started taking leadership role, and he said to me, look, don't come to meetings and speak general knowledge. Come and speak content, because we want to hear your views. That has been one of my pillars in terms of my role as a public rep. I've made it my point to go and research about issues. If I'm to speak, take a public platform and speak, that's what I think. But the other person that has been quite inspirational in my life is my mother. My mother always said to us and says, it doesn't matter what you do in life, do it to your best. Says, even if you are a sweeper, sweep to your best. What you do, people must ask after you have passed, who did this, because they should see the excellent work that you have done. And that, I keep it in my mind. Every time I do something, I get worried by those two people. Their voices keeps ringing in my head.
Sitting on your shoulder of conscience.
Exactly. To say, look, don't take a platform and speak general knowledge. But when you do something, don't do a shabby work. Go and do it to your best ability, because you can. Women have the ability to change the world. I believe that in our strong leadership, in our ability, but we have something that God gave us. I'm a strong believer, I'm a Christian. God gave us motherly instincts. And you know, we have strength as women, caring and all that. At times we think when we get into boardrooms, it's about being manlike. We are not supposed to be. Utilize your motherly instincts, utilize your warmth to make your way. Be a woman, be to the best of your ability, then you can do it. Do it your way, find your strength and do it.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for this conversation. Really appreciate it.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Ms. Mamoloko Kubai,
Member of Parliament and Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services.